we've got some amazing things that I might be able to get to tonight if I'll go ahead and begin. But we're going to go to Daniel 8. And we got the same thing going on with Daniel 8 that we have with Daniel 7. Daniel 8 is in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. The third year. So where do we put Daniel 8 if we put the chapters in chronological order? Well, right now we're down to here. It's going to come between Daniel 7, which occurred in the first year, and Daniel 5, which was his last year. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 5, 6. That's how we'll count them, okay, if we were to put the chapters in chronological order. Now, they didn't have to do that, but I just think that's kind of interesting to keep things in mind to see how this plays out chronologically. Got a question there?
She was just asking what it was.
Okay, Daniel 8 is between 7 and 5. Between 7 and 5. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 5, 6. That's how the things occur chronologically. Got it? Okay. Now, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. That's probably Daniel 7. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which was in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west. Well, this is going to be Alexander the Great. We call him Alexander the Great, and Daniel calls him Alexander the Goat. Okay? So kind of remember that. Alexander the Great thought he was great, but we're going to see here, God's the one who raised up Alexander the Great. It wasn't just how great Alexander was. God was involved in this. So the hand of providence continues to show itself through these 400 years, doesn't it? So, the he-goat came up from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. I mean, this thing is zooming across the ground. It says, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. That'd be the Alexander. Okay? And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close to the ram, and he was moved with choler. That's anger. I mean, this goat is an angry goat. He moved with choler against him and smote the ram and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Remember the four heads of the leopards? Okay. So Alexander the Great dies, and now it's divided up. The kingdom divided among four of his generals. Out of one there came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Think of the land of Israel now. This is out of those four. One of them is going to come over and have dominion over the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped on them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Later, I'll tell you the story of Antiochus Epiphanes. I won't get to that tonight, but kind of remember that I told you that. We're going to go over that later. A host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground and practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, until 2,300 days. Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And later, I won't tonight, but we're going to talk about Judas Maccabees. He cleansed the temple. That's why to this day the Jews celebrate Hanukkah. We're going to study about that as we get on into it. We won't get there tonight. Verse 15. And it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Eli, which called, and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end there shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground. But he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I'll make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. I bet you guessed that, didn't you? The Medes and the Persians. The two horns here. Okay? It's the bear lifted up from one side on the other. It's the breast and the arms of silver. And now there's the two horns on the ram. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. There's Alexander the Great. And we know what's going to happen. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Well, that's Alexander, first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressions are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper in practice, and shall destroy the mighty and holy people. Okay, we'll talk about that one later too. You have to keep that in mind. I'll refer you back to it when we get there. But now, and through his policy, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision, and it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished. Actually, I was astonished. I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Let me tell you what happened. The Persian Empire The Medes and the Persians are up here in ours. I'm going to have to get up there and show you. That's that big empire. Look how far it stretched. I mean, it went way, way, way to the east over here to India. It comes way, way here to the west, over here, Thrace, Macedonia, into Europe. It went way, way south, coming down here, including Egypt. The greatest amount of the world under the rule of one man that there ever was, right here in Persia. There had never been a kingdom like this. But it did not have Greece over here. That was still free of the Persians. So, I'm going to zoom in on this area right here to show you what happened. That arrow is pointing to Athens. Okay? Now, Athens, they always thought they really, that they're setting the pace for the Greeks. And they thought a lot of themselves doing that, but they really weren't in a lot of ways. They were setting the pace. And what would happen in these Greek cities over in here is they would grow. They'd get more people than they could feed. So what do you do? Well, we'll establish a colony somewhere else. The Athenians and the Greeks just ruled the Aegean Sea. There's islands all throughout. In the Old Testament, you read about the Isles of the Gentiles. Well, these are islands here all throughout. And they say that you can sail, and you're never so far away. Just sail a little longer, and you'll see a piece of land out there somewhere. So they could navigate across that Aegean Sea with their ships, and they knew their waters and their landmarks, and they were never really ever out of sight of land. Now, there'd be places they'd be out just a little bit, but they knew it's going to show up a little, and there it'd be, and they'd know how to guide themselves around. They didn't have GPS, see. They didn't even have a compass, but they knew the lands. And they established colonies of Greeks over here in Lydia. Now, we think of that as Asia Minor in our Bible maps, but it's called Lydia in old times. So these are Greek colonies. These are Greeks all across the Aegean Sea. I think it was one of them said, like frogs around the pond. Okay, that's where the Greek colonies were, all across the Aegean Sea. Now, the Persians, they conquered this and this, all this grain, and they had a lot of influence right down here, down to Thessaly, but this yellow and this purple, the Persians didn't conquer that. But these Greeks really didn't feel like Persians. They knew, these are our people over here. And we're being imposed upon. And the Greek mindset was that we're free people. The world was everywhere else. You take these big river valleys of the Nile, and the Tigris and Euphrates river valleys, big, vast plains. And to produce food in those plains, what you needed was an overseer and a lot of slaves. And you could really produce the food. You couldn't do that in this area. These are marginal lands. For a farmer to be successful in over here, he might have a slave or two. But he really had to understand his land and had to think through what he was doing. He didn't just follow instructions, because every bit of land was a little different. And you learn from your father how to produce off of that land. And so the Greeks, just by the topography and geography here, they had to be independent-minded. And so they always thought of themselves as independent, free men. They didn't think they were slaves. And here these Persians, they just treated by like, they're treating us like slaves over here. That's not who we are. Let's just quit doing what they say. They rebelled against the Persians. Well, Darius, he wasn't going to have that. He sent his army over there,
And in a little time, he brought all these back under subjugation, just killed a lot of them, did massacre them in their cities and all. I'll teach them a lesson. But in the meantime, they had appealed to Athens. They said, hey, we need help over here. And Athens sent aid to the Greek cities here in Persia. And the historian of the time says that when Darius asked, how are they able to put up such a fight? Said, well, Athens helped them. He said, where's Athens? He didn't care about these little places over here. Well, he said, tell you, we got to teach him a lesson. We'll go take Athens. That's what we're going to do. So, Darius got 100,000 men. I mean, this is an army that had never been defeated. And it was a vast army. He got the ships, loaded them up at Tyre and Sidon, put 100,000 men on ships. He's going to go up there and take Athens. Athens decided, we're not going to take this. They sent out a call for help. All these little cities around here said, look, we helped you all. Now they're coming after us. We need your help. And they were able to get together 20,000 men. However, you've got 100,000 Persians. They're outnumbered now 5-1, and little city Athens is standing up against the greatest empire the world had ever seen. So, what they did, the Persians, it's kind of blurry, but the Persians came in here and they landed at Marathon. That's where they unloaded their ships. And so you got 100,000 soldiers that had been in battle and know how to fight, and they're on the plains of Marathon, and these 20,000 men from Athens, they come over here, and they're going to try to walk up against 100,000 soldiers. Well, everybody's on edge. How could this, how in the world? And the Greeks had the idea, it'd be better to be dead than be a slave. They were fighting for themselves. These are a bunch of slaves fighting. They're following orders, but they don't really care. But now the Greeks, they cared. Everything was at stake. So they had the battle at Marathon. And the Greeks did something that the Persians were not expecting. They had a military tactic. It was a phalanx. Now, in the old way where you would fight, you just run out there and everybody start fighting one another. Okay, so you just start, this is like a free-for-all. And so with this way of fighting, every Greek was going to have to take down 5 Persians. And, you know, you couldn't win that way. But the Greeks had been fighting each other, and they developed tactics. And so when they got together, now, you know, it's one thing, kind of like family. You can fight in your family, but somebody come on, a whole family pulls together and fights whatever against the family. That's what's happened to the Greeks. And what they did, they had this phalanx. They'd work together. They'd have their shields, and they would form right across here is the front, and it was like a moving fort. I mean, you'd have all these men together with shields, and the men behind them had spears, and they were long spears. Now, they were weighted on their other end, so you could hold that spear way out, long with a heavy weight on the end. And when you're running up to this thing, you're not running up to one man. You're running up against a wall of shields with all these spears sticking out of it. They said they'd have it in 3 ranks of spears. And if you even got one, there's another one to fall in their place. And they learned to march together and go up. And I tell you, these Persians didn't know how to fight this thing. And the Greeks went out there. And they were slaughtering these Persians. And these Persians figured out, you know, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're up against. And they got their ships and went home. They won. And it was something no one in the world thought they could win. But the Athenians thought, I think we can do it. Now, on the road between Athens and Marathon is this statue. Okay? You can tell this fella's running. He wanted to be the first to get the word to Athens that we won. His name is Phidippides. I think that's how you say it. Phidippides. Okay? He wanted to be the first one. I gotta tell him. So he wanted to outrun everybody else that might be running. And he ran and he ran and he ran. He got to Athens and they saw him coming. And they opened the gates and they're all just breathless. What's going to happen to us? And he runs into the city. We won. We won. And all of Athens breaks forth in rejoicing and roaring in celebration. And he runs so hard he collapsed. And while the city is rejoicing, he dies in the street. That's how hard he is. He just literally ran himself to death. The distance he ran is about 26 miles. He ran from Marathon to Athens. And so today, you know how long a marathon is. It's a 26 mile run. There you go. And you can thank this fella here that ran to tell them the news. Well, this really embarrassed Darius. I mean, his army'd never been defeated. And these folks way over here, I mean, he didn't even know who they were. And they defeated his army. Well, he didn't like that. He went home, but before he could do anything about it, he died. And Ahasuerus became king. Now, history knows him as Xerxes, okay? Xerxes. And in fact, it's the same name. It's just a different form of that name. And I've read how that Xerxes could turn into Ahasuerus. But it's the Hebrew way you'd say Xerxes based on the alphabets and the letters and all. But that's who this is. History calls him Xerxes. Bible calls him Ahasuerus. And we read about him in the book of Esther. Now watch what happens here. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India unto Ethiopia over 120 provinces. So he had inherited Darius's kingdom, okay? Now, in those days, when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. What's he doing? Here's what history tells us. In the third year of his reign, he called all his folks together, said, we're going to plan invasion of Greece. Now, they drove my father Darius back out of there, and we're not going to have that. We're going to go back in, and we're going to show them who's boss, and we're going to take Greece. And he assembled the largest army the world had ever known. Now, they estimated. You know how estimates work. On the low side, the estimate is 250,000 soldiers. On the high side, it's 2,500,000. Now, that's a big gap, isn't it? So, kind of the way this is talked about sometimes, call it the million-man army. That'd be on the low side, all right? He got together a million-man army to go in and just overwhelm the Greeks. Now, to do that, he had to get his army over there. How do you get a million men? That's a lot of ships for a million men. Now, he had a lot of ships. I mean, he had he had 1,200-something ships that he was going to send at the same time. But he decided they would march there. But to march there, they had to cross this, how do you pronounce that, darling, the Bosphorus? Bosphorus. See, the Black Sea's up here, and there's a little channel of the sea going up, and they would have to cross that. How are you going to get a million men across this ocean river right here, out of the east into the west, out of Asia into Europe. How do you do it?
It's one of the great engineering feats of history. They built a floating bridge. And they were afraid that when they got out there, the horses would get scared. So they put fabric up on either side so you couldn't see over the edge. And they walked across a floating bridge, with lined up their boats, anchored them down, laid the planks across, put up the sheets, and marched a million in across that open body of water. I say that was the Greeks' protection. They thought they'd have to come by sea, but they didn't. They're marching into a map. So panic is setting in place down in Athens. What are we going to do? Well, I mean, there's one thing to fight off 100,000, but now there's 10 times that many, and they're coming after us. Well, they make their way down, and there's two places here that you need to see.
What they were going to do, his plan, will march the army around, and the ships, the 1,000, about 1,200, we're going to follow them with our ships. And the ships will go around as the army goes by land. So the Greeks say, we've got to separate those ships from the army. We're going to do any good. So the little Greek navy took off. They say they might have hit about 300 ships. Little Greek navy takes off, going against this big 1,200 ship navy. But the Greeks said, we can do it right here. I'm going to zoom in on this just a little bit. There are two places. This spot right here, you see that little cross? That was a naval battle. And then this part right here is a land battle, Thermopylae. Alright? And that's a narrow pass. See, they had to get around those mountains, and there's just a narrow pass to get through those mountains. And the Greeks were going to try to sneak up through here and stop that navy from following that army by blocking that little pass off. Well, pretty well worked. Greeks were pretty wily. They knew what they were doing. Let's zoom in on that area. This is the area. Thermopylae. Okay, can somebody pronounce that? Artemisium? I don't know, I should have looked it up, how to pronounce it. There it is. And then Athens, down here. So the Greeks are slipping off down here. And they're going to catch them right there. And then the Spartans. See, the Spartans got to Marathon the day after the battle. The Spartans always thought they were the best warriors in Greece. And they missed the great battle. And they didn't like that. They sure wish they'd gotten there a day earlier because they didn't get any of the glory. So they said, we'll get the glory this time. They went after a million-man army with 10,000 soldiers. That's what they were up against. But they had a narrow pass. We'll stop them at this narrow pass. And sure enough, that big army comes down through here, and they couldn't get past the Thermopylae. Well, there was another way around. And there was some Greek that thought, I can make some money off this. He went over to the Persians and said, I know how to get around that spot. And you can come in on them at the other side. And so he betrayed the Greeks. And they made it through that other pass and came up alongside. And Leonidas, he's the big Spartan general, he saw, buddy, we've had it. This isn't going to work anymore. I need to send my army home. He sent the 10,000 home, but he said, for them to get away, I need 300 men. We're going to hold the pass. So 300 against a million. They said, you try to stop a million-man army with 300 soldiers? They'll shoot so many arrows in the air, it'll block out the sun. And Leonidas said, then we'll fight them in the shade. And that's what they did. They held on, it was nearly a week, they just held on fighting, holding that little path until all 300 are dead. It's kind of like Texas and the Alamo. You know, remember the Alamo? Well, after this, the Greeks would say, remember Thermopylae. Okay. 300 held off that army. And Well, since they did that, the Greeks thought, well, there's no sense in holding the navy back anymore because the army's gone. So, but the Greeks, and they thought, the Persians thought we'll go around this way, but it says a storm wrecked a bunch of their boats, and that didn't work. But the Greeks went on back, got that back down to Athens, and said, we got to figure out what to do. They're coming. We tried everything to stop them. We can't stop them. They're coming. Someone in their assembly, it was their ecclesia. You know what that word means, they're called out. Someone in the Athenian ecclesia said, maybe we ought to surrender. And they killed him. They weren't going to consider surrender. So what do we do? Well, we can't keep them out of Athens. We won't surrender, but we got to abandon the town. Everybody, get your wife and your kids, what you can, head to the hills. And the Navy will do what it can. So when the Persians marched into Athens, the army made it on down, got to Athens, the city was empty. No one was there. And they tore it all to pieces. I mean, they wrecked that. They were going to humiliate these Greeks, and they just destroyed the city. But the little Navy got away. Now, I'm going to zero in on this area, right in here, okay? Because this arrow here goes across the island of Salamis. And I'll show you what happened there. See that? It's off Salamina, I think Salamis is what it usually called, Salamis. But the little Greek Navy said, we can't fight these folks in the open sea. They got us outnumbered, they got us outmanned, they got us outshipped. But the Greeks knew their waters. They knew the currents, they knew the tides, they knew the winds. We know how to maneuver in these waters in ways that these Persians don't know. Let's run back up in here where it's a smaller area. We know what we're doing back here. They're not going to know what they're doing. Here come the big Persian Navy. Pulls right up alongside. They look out, and man, their ships as far as you can see. And it spoofed some of the Greeks. They said, we better make a run for it. So we're not going to be able to whip these guys. They're just too many. And so they thought they would get out here and slip away. Well, what is Navy commander? You call him a commander? Or Navy, the admiral, whoever he was. I knew his name, but I can't think of it now. But he said, I'm not going to let that happen. So here's what he did. I mean, any other time he'd think this was treason. He sent someone over to the Persians and told them what was up. He said, you know, those Greeks are going to try to get away because they're not in a bay. This is an island. And if you want to stop them, you send some of your ships over here and you can catch them on their way out. And so he betrayed, the admiral betrayed the Greek Navy. But he did it for two reasons. One is that's going to get rid of some of those ships. The numbers are going to be down now. Not a lot, but it'll help. Every little ship counts now. But the second was, there was nothing left for the Greeks to do but fight. There's no escape. And so we've got to fight them. And so now the Greeks are together. They can't get out. They've got them blocked. They've got to fight. So here comes the Persian Navy. And the little Greek Navy's out there, and they're kind of spread out. You know, and the Greek Navy's coming in mass, but the Persians the Persian Navy's coming in there, but the Persian Navy made a mistake. They had so many boats coming in so close together. I mean, it'd scare you to death, but they couldn't maneuver. I mean, every time they try to turn a ship, they're bumping into another ship, and there's more behind them, and they're kind of committed, and here they come. And the Greeks kind of figured they'd do that. And they're out there where they can maneuver, and they started ramming those ships in the sides, and those ships started going down one after another, and Xerxes, he's sitting over here, and he can watch the battle, and he sees his navy going down one after another. Some of them tried to get away. They took off and tried to find their way out of there and get on out of there. But the Greeks had hid some ships back over in here, expecting that some would try to get away. As soon as they rounded the cape, those Greek ships shut off. Now they're rowing these things. You know, they're sitting there rowing these things with many rowers. They took off and they started ramming the ones that were trying to get away, and they went down. And Xerxes was watching his whole navy being destroyed before him. And so he decided he would go home. So he went on home and he left the army there, just turned it over to a general and says, "Well, you can take care of it from here." He went on home, and over the next year, the Greeks were able to harry the rest of the Persians that were left until just, I think, 3,000 made it back across the Bosphorus to get away, and they still never conquered Athens. Athens now was indisputably the lead city of the Greeks. Everyone thought, we got to follow Athens' lead. Everyone but Sparta. Now, this is the golden age of Athens. Pericles was the ruler of Athens. And since their city was destroyed, he rebuilt it. And he rebuilt it magnificently. And that's when the Parthenon was built, while Pericles was reigning. There's a replica of it in Nashville. But now that's made out of concrete. This is made entirely out of marble. And the engineering on this thing is just fantastic. They made the columns where they leaned in just a little and they tapered. And it's all to give the optical illusion of something. And it makes it even seem greater than it is. And so it still stands to this day on the Acropolis there that Pericles built to thank the gods for the deliverance from the Persians. And Athens was pretty much running the show. This was also the days of, Well, Athens, they're pretty much running the show, but Sparta. Now, Sparta never got along with anybody. And the Spartans said, well, we're not going to follow Athens around. We're not going to do that. I tell you what, we'll take over. So the Spartans down here, they had their cities. And the Athenians here had their cities. And Athens really had it. They were so much greater than Sparta. But it's like some people, you can't leave well enough alone. They said, we'll bring Sparta into this too. And so they got into a fight. And those cities fought one another, and sometime one would win, and sometime, and they just expended all their resources and just pretty much destroyed themselves over who got to be the big dog between Athens and Sparta. And so the Spartans really picked up a fight there. Actually, the Spartans won that at the end and subdued Athens. But those were the days of the great philosophers. The Greeks, being independent-minded like they were, started thinking. And they're thinking, what is all this anyway we're looking at? I mean, we know about all the gods and all their stories, but just think about this. What is substance? They actually came up with the atomic theory back in ancient Greece, thinking, things can be divided down to some unindivisible piece that cannot be divided any further. And they were trying to figure out what all the world was about. And they were thinking scientifically, but then they were also thinking morally and ethically. You know, there's right and wrong. But what determines what is right and wrong? Well, you can't depend on the gods. I mean, the gods are always committing adultery and trying to cheat each other in life. They're as big a mess as we are. But we know some of those gods are doing wrong, and they're doing. How do you know what's right, and how do you know what's wrong? Well, they started giving that a lot of thought. And Socrates was one that kept raising these questions. Socrates was kind of irritating. A lot of people didn't like him. because he really didn't offer any solutions. But he's always coming up with questions. And he just asked and asked and asked to drive people crazy. But a lot of the young people really thought, you know, Socrates is making us think. And the young people really liked him. And it got the older people worried about the young people thinking so much. And so they put Socrates to death. And he acted like he was glad to go. He was getting old. He said, you're just cutting off the last few years of my life, and they're going to be miserable anyway, so let me drink this poison and get it over with. And he died. In fact, when they found him guilty, it was a large majority that found him guilty, but then they were going to sentence him to death. And they gave Socrates, but you don't have to, you can be banished if you want to. He said, I don't want to be banished. I'm not going to do that. He says, I'm not going to let you get away with it. I'm going to let you be the fools to put me to death. Well, he made them so mad, there's more of them voted to put him to death than they did voted to find him guilty. Well, anyway, he went on and died. But one of his students was Plato. Did that go dim on me? Yeah, it's going dim on me. Okay, Plato. And Socrates didn't write anything, but a lot of what we know about Socrates is what Plato wrote. One of his students was Aristotle. So you got Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. And when Philip came down and took over Greece, which he was able to do because they'd all destroyed each other pretty much, and it wouldn't be just a cakewalk for him to walk in and take it. He took Greece, and his son, Alexander, this thing's fading on me. I'm talking too long, aren't I? They said, Alexander, I want him to be taught. So they got Aristotle to teach Alexander when he was a boy growing up. And that's where Alexander fell in love with Greek culture. Now, Alexander was a Macedonian. But he thought, you know, the whole world needs to know about this. And one of the reasons he wanted to conquer the world was to spread this Greek culture all over the world. Well, that's what happened. Let's see. Macedonia and Achaia. Philip, up in Macedonia, he marched in with the Macedonians to unite the Greeks. Now, Athens tried that and failed. And Sparta tried that and they failed. And Thessaly had tried that and they failed. They couldn't get all the Greeks together. In fact, they just fought each other. But Philip came down with his army, and he took control. Well, the Greeks thought, oh no, these Macedonians, they're just going to treat us awful. But here's what Philip did. He said, listen, if you all will cooperate with me and unite under me, I'll leave you alone. You don't go back to ruling your city states the way you want to, as long as you'll cooperate with me. Well, the Greeks thought, what a deal. And they all united under Philip, the Macedonian, when they never could unite under themselves. And so he had all Greece united, and Philip had laid these plans. We're going to go back over there and teach those Persians a lesson. Because, see, we know what we're doing, and they don't know what they're doing. But Philip died. He didn't get to do it. And his son, Alexander, was about 20 years old. Now, Alexander was smart, and Alexander was good looking. And Alexander was very capable. He'd been in all kind of athletic contests and won. He was an excellent horseman. He could out-wrestle and out-fight and out-throw. And he was really something. And he said, I'll take over since Dad's dead. And we're going to march out there. We're going to do it. And everyone just seemed to love Alexander. He had a charisma about him. And the soldiers fell in love with him. And so here's the he-goat with the one big horn. The Greeks and the Macedonians under the big horn, Alexander the Great. And he marches out here, and here's what he does. His first battle is right here as soon as he lands. And sure enough, they whipped those Persians, and they went packing, and they're headed back into Persia to warn them, the Greeks are coming, the Greeks are coming. Well, then he went through and captured Sardis, where the Persians kind of had their capital over there in Asia Minor. He went down to Ephesus and made himself up here, took a detour, and went up to Gordium. Gordium's interesting because there was this temple there that had a rope in it. And someone had tied this rope into a knot called the Gordian knot. And the legend was that if anyone could untie the Gordian knot, they could rule the world. So that's what Alexander wanted to do. So I'll go untie the Gordian knot.
Nobody's ever been able to do that.
Alexander went in and he saw the knot. He took his sword and whacked it in two and spread it out. So that didn't solve that. And now he's going to take the world. That's why he went up there to do it. And I mean, the army, when he did, they just loved him. They thought, boy, this guy, he is really something. So they're all following him. And he goes over here to have another battle with the Persians. And he whipped them again. Darius, buddy, he is worried now. So he takes off. He's running back over to Shushan, the palace. And they thought, best thing for us to do is retreat and regroup. And we'll try to fight him again as he comes on this way. But Alexander says, I'm not going to chase him that way. What I'm going to do, I'm going to run down here and take care of the, you know, you back behind the lines. I'm going to take care of all this while the Persians are out of the way. He came down to Tyre. I can tell this. Alexander the Great took Tyre. Tyre was two cities. It was a city on the mainland, and it was a city on an island out from the mainland. And every time Tyre was under attack, the people floated out to this island, and they were protected by the sea. And the Phoenicians, they had ships, so they had the navy and the island. And all you could do is take the old city, but you couldn't take the island city until Alexander came. Now, we read about this in Zechariah chapter 9. The burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be the rest thereof, when the eyes of man, as all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. And Hamath also shall border thereby Tyre and Zidon, though it be very wise. And Tyrus did build herself a stronghold, and heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out. He will smite her power in the sea. Now that's on the island. That hadn't been done before. He'll smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire. That's what Alexander did. He got out there. He got his engineers together and said, okay, we got to cross the sea to take that island. How are we going to do it? And the engineers looked up and said, well, look at all these nice cities up here today. I mean, we can use them. And we got this city here, old Tyre. Let's just tear it all down and throw it in the sea. And we'll build a causeway all the way out to the island, and you can march your army across that. Well, they're peeking over the walls, and they see what he's doing. They think, well, he's going to fortify the coast. But next thing you know, he's coming their way. And they figured out, he's trying to get, you know. They went out and tried to stop him, but they used those cedars of Lebanon and built forts along the way to protect the men while they're throwing the debris, and they're going back and forth, and here they come, here they come. Nothing they were able to do to stop him. He made it all the way over to the island. He brought his siege engines across that thing and battered their walls down. And the Greeks took Tyre in the sea. And so Alexander the Great conquered Tyre. Now, it took him so long. It took him 7 months. He didn't want to take that long. And Alexander the Great had been very generous to his captives, but he wasn't generous to Tyre. He slaughtered them. And any that survived, he sold as slaves. He got rid of Tyre. Well, the Philistines are going to see this. Ascalon shall see it.
Gaza shall also see it and be very sorrowful. Ekron, for her expectation shall be a shame, and the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ascalon shall not be inhabited, and a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines, and I will take away his blood out of his mouth, and abominations from between his teeth, but he that remaineth, even he shall be for our God, and he shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron is a Jebusite. And I will encamp around my house because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returneth, and no oppressor shall pass between them any more. For now I've seen with mine eyes. God was going to protect Jerusalem, but the Philistines, you don't read about any Philistines in the New Testament. Alexander wiped them out. Now they'd already suffered under Babylon and under Persia. But any remnant of Philistines was wiped out by Alexander. And there are no Philistines. Those Palestinians aren't Philistines, okay? Over in the Gaza Strip, they're Arabs that moved in later. The Philistine people that came from the sea are no more. Alexander destroyed them. Alexander the Great, warrior king. This is why this is so interesting. There's another king. He's not going to be like Alexander at all. He's not going to ride in on his high horse and conquer everything. The next verse, Zechariah 9 and verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass. And upon the colt, the foal of an ass. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. There's never been a king like Jesus. Alexander the Great was a great earthly king. But Jesus, the meek and lowly, is the great spiritual king, greater than any king that has ever been, far above all principality and power and might. When you couple this prophecy of Jesus riding to Jerusalem on the foal of an ass, and compare that to the great horseman Alexander, and the two contrast in what kind of king they were. It comes out here in Zechariah chapter 9. I'm out of time. I'm out of time. I'll tap you over. To be continued. Okay? To be continued. Because we're going to find out what happens to Alexander when he goes down to Egypt. And I'll just have to wait. It's really fascinating what happened. Okay, we'll talk about that then next week. And so then we'll get back into Scripture. We're going from Scripture to history. Scripture to history. I got pretty much done everything I thought I'd do tonight. I didn't think I'd have time, but I'm glad I did. Hope you weren't bored with it too much.